Anna. I catch Laura looking at her watch. She's working her way through a stack of papers, heaping half of them onto a pile for the shredder. It's making me itch. Anything relating to work should be in the showroom, but what if she accidentally destroys something important? I'm a director of the business, albeit a somewhat passive one. I can't just throw paperwork away without checking what it's for. The weight of my gaze makes Laura look up. All right. You should get off. Mark will be back soon. I promised I'd stay till he got back. She puts another sheaf of papers on the shredding pile. Blame me. I haul myself to my feet and hold out a hand to help Laura up. We haven't finished sorting this lot. We've done loads. It's practically finished. It's a gross exaggeration. Laura's piles of things to keep and things to throw have merged, and I'm no longer sure whether I'm keeping a giant ball of rubber bands because I'm sentimental, or because they're useful, or because they've slid from one pile to the other. It's a mess. That's easily solved. I pick up Ella, usher Laura out of the room, and shut the study door. Ta-da! Anna, I thought we agreed that wasn't the way to deal with things. You agreed, I think, then immediately feel unfair. It was my idea to sort through my parents' study. Me who asked Laura to help. I'm not ignoring it because it's upsetting, though. I'm ignoring it because I don't want to tidy anymore. Completely different. Laura narrows her eyes at me, unconvinced by my breezy tone. What are you going to do about the card? You're probably right. Some sick joker with an axe to grind. Right. She's still not sure if she should leave me. I'm fine, I promise. I'll call you tomorrow. I find her coat and wait patiently while she looks for her keys. If you're sure, I am. We hug, and as she walks to her car, I stand at the door, one hand on Rita's collar to stop her running after phantom squirrels. Laura's car gives a splutter, then cuts out. She grimaces, tries again, revving hard to keep it from cutting out, and backs out of the driveway, waving from the open window. When I can no longer hear the sound of her car, I return to the study. I survey the piles of papers, the birthday cards, the pens and paper clips and post-it notes. There are no answers here, only memories. Memories I want to keep. I take the lid off a box of photographs and sift through them. On top are 6 or 7 photos of Mum and Laura's mum, Alicia. In one, they're in a sunny pub garden. In another, a cafe, having a cream tea. In another, the photo has been taken from an angle, as though the camera was propped up and slipping to one side. Mum and Alicia lie on their stomachs on a bed, Laura between them. She's perhaps 2 years old, which makes Mum and Alicia no more than 18. Just kids themselves. There are dozens more photos in the box, but all, as far as I can tell, of Dad, the showroom, me as a baby. I have lots of photos of Dad, but hardly any of Mum. Always behind the lens, never in front of it. Like so many women once they have a family. So intent on documenting their children's lives before they grow too old, it doesn't occur to them to document their own. That one day, their children will want to pore over photos of a time they were too young to remember. In the short time between Mum going missing and her suicide being established, I gave the police the only clear photo I had of her, which lived in a silver frame on the mantelpiece in the sitting room. They circulated it immediately, and when news of her death broke, the papers used the same photo to accompany the story. The police gave me back the framed picture, but every time I looked at it, I saw the headlines. Eventually, I had to put it away. Apart from their wedding photo, where she's hardly visible beneath the floppy hat that was all the rage at the time, there are no other photos of Mum on display. I put the ones of Mum and Alicia to one side, so I can have a couple framed. I open Mum's 2016 appointment diary. It's a fat A4 book, with each day over 2 pages. Appointments on the left, and space for notes on the opposite side. It's nothing fancy. A corporate gift from a car manufacturer. But I run my fingers over the gilt-embossed logo and feel the weight of the pages as it falls open in my hands. The diary is filled with Mum's writing, and the words are illegible until I blink hard to stop them swimming. Every day is full. Meetings with suppliers, repair visits booked for the photocopier, the coffee machine, the water cooler. On the right-hand side, that day's to-do list, with items neatly scored through when complete. If you want something done, ask a busy person. Wasn't that what they said? Mum couldn't have fitted more into her life if she'd tried. Yet, I never heard her complain she had too much on her plate. When her own mother, a crotchety woman who rationed her affection like wartime sugar, was admitted to a hospice, Mum drove each day from Eastbourne to Essex, returning only once Granny was sleeping. It was only afterwards Dad and I found out about the lump Mum had found in her own breast, the anxious wait she'd had for the all clear. "I didn't want to worry you," was all she'd say. The mix of work and home in the diary blindsides me. Adele tickets for A's birthday is sandwiched between a reminder to call a Katie Clements back about a test drive and the phone number for the local radio station. I press the heels of my palms into my eyes. I wish I'd looked through Mum and Dad's things earlier. I wish I'd known on my birthday what she'd thought of as a present. I can't help myself. I turn to the 21st of December and look at the day she died. There are two appointments and a list of tasks left incomplete. Tucked into the back of the diary are a handful of business cards, leaflets, and scribbled notes. The diary is a cross-section of Mum's life, as illuminating as an autobiography and as personal as a journal. I slip the photos inside and hug the book to my chest for a moment, and then I start to put everything back where it came from. I replace the desk tidy, and with it the paperweight I made from clay and painted when I was in primary school. It used to live on the dresser in the kitchen, holding down the myriad classroom letters. I run my finger over the superglued crack that divides it neatly in two, and I have a sudden, sharp memory of the sound it made when it hit the wall. There were apologies. Tears. Mine. Mum's. "Good as new," Dad said, once the glue had dried. But it wasn't, and nor was the patch of wall where he filled the dent and painted over it in a shade that didn't quite match what had gone before. I wouldn't talk to him for days. I pull out the bottom drawer of the desk and retrieve the bottle of vodka. It's empty. Most of them are. They're everywhere. At the back of the wardrobe, in the toilet cistern, wrapped in a towel in the depths of the airing cupboard. I find them, I pour away the contents, and I push the glass to the bottom of the recycling bin. If there were bottles before I went to university, they were better hidden. Or I didn't notice them. I returned home to a life that had altered in my absence. Were my parents drinking more? Or had I had my eyes opened to a world beyond the narrow scope of my childhood? After I found the first bottle, there seemed to be hundreds, like learning a word and then seeing it everywhere. An involuntary shiver tickles my spine. "Someone walking over your grave," Mum used to say. It's dark outside. I catch a glimpse of something moving in the garden. My heart thumps, but when I look properly, it's my own pale face staring back at me, distorted by the old glass. A noise outside makes me jump. "Pull yourself together, Anna. It's this room. It's full of memories, not all of them good. It's making me jumpy. I'm imagining things. A ghostly figure in the window, footsteps outside. But wait. I do hear footsteps. Slow and deliberate, as though the owner were trying not to be heard. A soft crunch of gravel underfoot. There's someone outside. There are no lights on upstairs, and none down here, save for the desk light in the study. From the outside, the house will be in near darkness. Could it be a burglar? This street is filled with high-value properties, crammed with antiques and paintings bought as much for investment as for show. As the business grew, My parents spent their money on beautiful things, many of which could be easily seen through the downstairs windows. Perhaps someone came by earlier, when Ella and I were at the police station, and decided to return under cover of darkness. Maybe. A hard knot of fear forms in my throat. Maybe they've been observing for a while. All day I've been unable to lose the feeling I'm being watched, and now I wonder if my instincts have been correct. As a child, I knew the code for the burglar alarm long before I could memorize our telephone number, but it hasn't been set since Mark moved in. He wasn't used to living in a house with an alarm. He'd set it off every time he came home, cursing in frustration as he fumbled with the keypad. "Rita's enough of a deterrent, surely," he said, after telling the alarm company that yes, it was another false alarm. I'd fallen out of the habit of setting it myself, and now that I was home all day with Ella, we had stopped using it entirely. I consider setting it now, but I know I won't be able to fathom how to zone it in the dark, and the thought of being there, by the front door, as a burglar tries to get in, brings goosebumps to my arms. I should take Ella upstairs. I can pull the chest of drawers in her room across the door. They can take what they want from down here, it doesn't matter. I assess the sitting room with an objective eye, wondering what they're after. The television, I suppose, and the obvious things like the silver punch bowl that once belonged to my great-grandmother and now holds African violets. On the mantelpiece are two porcelain birds I bought for my parents on their anniversary. They aren't valuable, but they look as though they could be. Should I take them with me? If I take the birds, what else should I take? So many memories in this house. So much I would grieve over. Impossible to take it all. It's hard to work out exactly where the footsteps are. The quiet crunch of gravel gets louder, as though the prowler walked first to one side of the house and is now returning to the other. I take up my mobile, lying next to the baby monitor. Should I call the police? A neighbor? I pick up my mobile phone and scroll through numbers until I find Robert Drake's. I hesitate, not wanting to call him, but knowing it makes sense to do so. He's a surgeon. He'll be good in an emergency, and if he's still at home next door, he can come out and take a look, or just turn on the outside lights and scare off whoever's out there. His phone is switched off. The crunch of footsteps on gravel gets louder, competing with the rush of blood singing in my ears. I hear a dragging noise. A ladder? To the side of the house, between the graveled front drive and the landscaped back garden, is a narrow strip of land with a shed and a log store. I hear a dull bang that could be the shed door. My heart accelerates. I think of the anonymous card, of my haste to take it to the police. Did I do the wrong thing? Was the card meant as a warning? That whatever happened to Mum could happen to me, too? Maybe it isn't burglars outside. Maybe whoever killed my mother wants me dead, too. Chapter 11. Murray. Tom Johnson had been missing for 15 hours when his wife, Caroline Johnson, at 48, 10 years Tom's junior, called the police. She hadn't seen Tom since they'd had what she called a stupid spat, as they'd left work the previous day. He said he was going to the pub, her statement read. When he didn't come home, I thought he'd gone to his brother's to sleep it off. Their daughter, Anna, who lived at home with them, had been away at a conference in London with the children's charity for whom she had worked since leaving university. Tom Johnson hadn't turned up for work the next day. Murray found the statement from Billy Johnson, Tom's brother and business partner, who had been unconcerned by Tom's absence. I assumed he had a hangover. He's a partner. What was I supposed to do? Give him a final warning? Even in the dry black and white of a witness statement, Billy Johnson came across as defensive. It was a natural reaction for many people, a way of diffusing the guilt they felt at not seeming to have cared enough when it mattered. The MISPER report had been completed by uniform and graded as low risk. Murray looked at the officer's name, but didn't recognize it. None of the information at that stage had suggested that Tom Johnson had been vulnerable, but that wouldn't have stopped questions being asked when his suicide was reported. It wouldn't have stopped that officer questioning their own judgment. Would grading Tom as high risk have changed anything? It was impossible to know. Nothing about Tom Johnson's disappearance had given rise to concern. He was a successful businessman, well known across the town. A family man with no history of depression. The first text message had come at 9:30 a.m. I'm sorry. Ironically, Caroline Johnson had been relieved. I thought he was apologizing for the row we'd had, she said in her statement. He shouted at me, said a few things that had upset me. He had a temper, but he always said sorry afterwards. When the text came, I thought at least he's okay. He had a temper. Murray underlined the words. How much of a temper had Tom Johnson had? Could he have argued with someone at the pub that night? Got into a fight? Inquiries at Tom's usual haunts had drawn a blank. Wherever he'd gone to drown his sorrows the night before he died, it hadn't been his local. A request by the attending officer to trace Tom's phone had been refused, as at that stage there had been no evidence of a threat to life. Murray winced on behalf of the senior officer who made that call. It was a decision that had swiftly been reversed when Caroline had received a second text from her husband. I think he's going to kill himself. Murray listened to the recording of Caroline Johnson's 999 call. He closed his eyes, feeling her distress pulse through him as though it were his own. He heard her read out the message she had received from her husband, noted the calm response from the operator as she asked Caroline what was her husband's number and could she please keep that text message. I can't do this anymore. The world will be a better place without me in it. He couldn't do what? It was the sort of heat-of-the-moment comment anyone might make. It could mean nothing, or it could mean everything. I can't do this anymore. Stay married? Have an affair? Lie? What had Tom Johnson been doing that had led to such an outpouring of guilt? There had been no further texts. Tom Johnson's mobile had rung out. Triangulation placed it near Beachy Head. ANPR cameras pinpointed the car he'd taken from work heading towards the same location, and officers were dispatched. Even though Murray knew the outcome of the job, he felt a pounding in his chest as he read through the pages of the log, imagining how it would have felt for the police officers involved in the race to save a life. A call from a member of the public, Diane Brent Taylor, reported seeing a man put rocks into a rucksack. It had struck her as an odd activity for a man in a suit, and she stood and watched as he made his way to the edge of the cliff. Horrified, she saw him remove his wallet and phone from his pocket, before taking a step forward and disappearing. Murray read the transcript of the call. The tide's high, there's nothing there. I can't see him. Coastal Rescue were in the water within minutes, but it was already too late. There was no sign of Tom Johnson. Murray took a steadying breath. He wondered how Ralph Metcalf, the coroner, coped with hearing stories about the dead day in, day out. He wondered whether he got used to it, or whether he went home and sank into a bottle of something to numb the senses. Officers had scoured the area where Mrs. Brent Taylor had described seeing Tom go over the edge. They found his wallet and his mobile phone, the screen still showing the frantic messages from his wife. Where are you? Don't do this. We need you. Police had broken the news to Caroline Johnson in the kitchen of her home address, where she had been surrounded by family. A photocopied pocket notebook entry from P.C. Woodward listed the names, occupations, and contact details of the friends and family who had gathered to support Caroline. William, Billy, Johnson, director at Johnson's Cars, brother-in-law. Robert Drake, consultant surgeon, Royal Sussex. Neighbour. Laura Barnes, receptionist at Hard as Nails. Goddaughter. Anna Johnson's details. Regional coordinator for Save the Children. Daughter. Had been recorded on a later page, suggesting she had arrived after PC Woodward had taken the initial roll call. In the days following Tom Johnson's death, numerous inquiries had been carried out as CID officers had put together a file for the coroner. The content of Tom's smartphone had been extracted, including web searches made in the early hours of the 18th of May for Beachy Head suicide location and Tide Times Beachy Head. Murray noted that high tide had occurred at 10:04 a.m., Diane Brent Taylor's call coming in only a minute later. The water would have been around 6 meters deep at that point, easily deep enough to swallow a man weighed down with rocks, the undertow dragging him out past the tide line. If his body was ever recovered, what would be left of him, 19 months on? Would there be anything to say whether Tom Johnson was alone on the edge of the cliffs that morning? The witness, Diane Brent Taylor, hadn't seen anyone with Tom. She'd refused to give a statement or to attend an inquest. After several telephone conversations, during which Diane had been evasive to the point of obstruction, the police call handler had finally established that Diane had been on Beachy Head with a married man, with whom she had been having an affair. The clandestine couple had been as anxious to keep their rendezvous a secret as the police were to take a statement, and nothing could persuade Diane to commit her name to paper. The timeline in Murray's notebook was complete. The investigation into Tom Johnson's death had been concluded within a fortnight, the files submitted, and the CID officers assigned to other jobs. There had been a delay of several months, while permission had been obtained to hold an inquest without a body, but as far as the investigation was concerned, the job was done. Suicide. Tragic, but not suspicious. End of story. Except, was it? There were several CDs in the box file of CCTV footage seized during the immediate fear for Tom Johnson's welfare. They didn't appear to have been viewed, and Murray imagined the case had already reached its sad conclusion before the officers had had a chance to look at the hours of footage they potentially contained. Could the discs hold evidence of a crime so well hidden it was never even identified as one? The brand new Audi, taken by Tom from Johnson's cars on the day he disappeared, had been given a cursory search, but with everything pointing towards suicide, not murder, no budget was allocated for forensic testing. Like the CCTV, though, evidence had been secured, and Murray wondered if there was any point in submitting the swabs and stray hairs seized from the car. But what would that prove? There was no suspect with whom to compare evidence seized, and the car was a forecourt special. Who knew how many test drives it had hosted? More pertinently, how would Murray get a submission signed off when he wasn't even supposed to be dealing with the job? So far, nothing Murray had found suggested anything was amiss in the coroner's verdict of suicide. Perhaps Caroline Johnson's file would yield more interest. The police response to Anna Johnson's 999 call had been swift and extensive. The family's address was already flagged, and this time there was no question of grading Caroline Johnson as anything other than a high-risk, vulnerable misper. "My father's death hit her hard," Anna Johnson's statement read. "I had started working from home so I could keep an eye on her. I was really worried. She didn't eat. She was jumpy every time the phone rang. And some days, she wouldn't even get out of bed." So far, so normal, Murray thought. Grief hit everyone in a different way, and bereavement by suicide carried an extra burden. Guilt, however misplaced, weighed heavy on the soul. On the 21st of December, Caroline Johnson had told her daughter she needed some air. "She'd been distracted all day," Anna had said. "I kept catching her looking at me, and twice she told me she loved me. She was behaving oddly, but I put it down to the fact that we were both dreading our first Christmas without Dad." At lunchtime, Caroline went to get milk. "She took the car. I should have realized straight away something was wrong. We always get milk from the shop at the end of the road. It's quicker to walk. As soon as I noticed the car had gone, I knew something awful was going to happen." The police were called at 3 p.m. A response officer who knew the family's history, and with too many Beachy Head jobs under his belt to be optimistic, had phoned the chaplaincy office. For years, the charity had offered crisis intervention, proactive patrols and search teams, all aimed at reducing Beachy Head's annual death toll. An eager chaplain had confirmed that yes, he had indeed seen a woman matching that description, but that the officer could rest easy. She hadn't jumped. Murray put down Anna Johnson's statement and found the entry on the call log where the update from the attending officer, PC 956 Gray, had been posted. Chaplin states he had a long conversation on edge of cliff with an IC-1 female in her 50s. Subject was in a distressed state and carrying rucksack filled with stones. Subject stated her name was Caroline and that she had recently lost her husband to suicide. The chaplain had talked Caroline back from the edge. "I waited while she took the stones out of her rucksack," his statement read. "We walked back to the car park. I told her God was always ready to listen, to forgive, that nothing was so bad God wouldn't help us through it." Murray admired those whose faith gave them such immense peace of mind. He wished he felt that depth of belief when he went into a church, but there were too many terrible things in the world for him to accept they were all part of God's grand plan. Had even the chaplain's faith been shaken by what happened next? Had he sent up a prayer to help him come to terms with it? Caroline's photo had been circulated, additional patrols sent to Beachy Head. Coast Guard Rescue worked in conjunction with the police, with the chaplaincy, as they were so often required to do. Volunteers and salaried officers working side by side. Different backgrounds, different training, but the same aim. To find Caroline Johnson alive. Caroline's phone had been identified as being at or near Beachy Head, and just after 5 p.m., her handbag and mobile phone were found by a dog walker on the edge of the cliff. The tide had been at its highest at 4:33 p.m. that day. A BMW, parked in the car park at Beachy Head, with the keys in the ignition, was quickly traced back to Johnson's cars, where Billy Johnson confirmed that the description given by the chaplain matched that of his sister-in-law, Caroline Johnson, a fellow director of Johnson's cars, and the recent widow of Billy's brother, Tom Johnson. With the exception of the suicidal texts, Caroline had sent none, it was a carbon copy of Tom Johnson's suicide 7 months previously. How must Anna have felt to answer the door to another policeman with his hat in his hands, to sit in the kitchen with the same friends and family gathered around, another investigation, another funeral, another inquest? Murray put down the file and let out a slow sigh. How many times had Sarah tried to take her own life? Too many to count. The first had come a few weeks into their relationship, when Murray had gone to play squash with a colleague instead of seeing Sarah. He had returned home to find 7 messages on his answer phone, each more desperate than the last. Murray had panicked that time, and the next. Sometimes there were months between attempts. On other occasions, Sarah would try several times a day to end her life. It would be these times that would prompt another stay at Highfield. Gradually, he had learned that what Sarah needed was for him to be calm. To be there, not judging, not panicking. And so, he would come home and hold her, and if she didn't need to go to hospital, as, more often than not, she didn't, Murray would bathe her arms and gently wrap gauze across the cuts, and reassure her he wasn't going anywhere. And only when Sarah was in bed, the lines on her forehead smoothed out by sleep, would Murray put his head in his hands and weep. Murray rubbed his face. Focus. This job was supposed to fill some time, distracting him from thinking about Sarah, not sending him down memory lanes he wished he'd never travelled. He looked at his notebook, now filled with his neat handwriting. Nothing seemed out of place. So why would someone question Caroline's death? To stir up trouble? To upset Anna? Suicide? Think again. Something had transpired that day that wasn't in the police file. Something the investigating officers hadn't seen. It happened. Not often, but it happened. Sloppy detectives, or simply busy ones, prioritizing other cases, filing the dead ends when perhaps, just perhaps, there were more questions to ask, more answers to find. Murray picked up the final sheaf of paperwork, miscellaneous documents in no apparent order, a photograph of Caroline Johnson, a copy of the contact list from her phone, and a copy, of Tom Johnson's life assurance policy. Murray looked at the latter, and looked again. Tom Johnson had been worth a considerable amount of money. Murray hadn't seen Anna's house, but he knew the street, a quiet, sought-after avenue with its own gated park, and properties there didn't come cheap. Murray assumed the house would have been jointly owned by the Johnsons, and would since have passed to their daughter, as would, he imagined, the payout from Tom's hefty life assurance policy. And that was before you factored in the family business, of which Anna now had joint control. Whichever way you looked at it, Anna Johnson was an extremely wealthy woman. Chapter 12. Anna. I fumble with my phone, finding recent calls and pressing Mark's number as I tiptoe into the hall towards the stairs, Ella in my arms. I silently beseech her not to make a sound. And then three things happen. The crunch of gravel beneath feet becomes the solid tap of shoes on steps. The tinny ringing of Mark's phone at my ear is mirrored by a louder version coming from outside the house, and the front door opens. When Mark walks into the house, his ringing mobile still in his hand, he finds me standing in the hall, wild-eyed and high from the adrenaline coursing through my veins. "You rang, m'lady?" He grins and taps his phone to end the call. Slowly, I lower my own mobile from my ear, my heart rate refusing to accept the danger has passed. I laugh awkwardly, relief making me as light-headed as fear did a moment ago. "I heard someone walking around outside. I thought they wanted to get in." "Someone did?" "Me." Mark comes forward to kiss me, Ella sandwiched between us. He drops a kiss on our daughter's forehead, then takes her from my arms. "You were creeping about. Why didn't you come straight in?" My irritated tone is unfair, a byproduct of the panic slowly dissipating through my bloodstream. Mark tilts his head to one side and surveys me with more patience than my shortness merits. "I was putting the bins out. It's collection day tomorrow." He addresses Ella in a sing-song voice.
"Isn't it? Yes, it is."
I squeeze my eyes closed for a beat. The dragging noise that might have been a ladder, the thud of the bin store door. Noises so familiar I should have known instantly what they were. I follow Mark into the sitting room, where he turns on the lights and settles Ella in her beanbag chair.
"Where's Laura?"
"I sent her home.
She said she'd stay. I'd have come back earlier."
"I don't need a babysitter. I'm fine."
"Are you?"
He takes each of my hands in his and holds my arms wide. I wriggle away from his inspection.
"Yes.
No.
Not really." "So where's this card?"
"The police have got it." I show him the same photos I showed Laura, and watch him zoom in on the writing. He reads aloud.
"Suicide. Think again."
"You see? My mother was murdered."
"That's not what it says, though."
"But that's the implication, isn't it?" Mark looks at me thoughtfully.
"Alternatively, it was an accident."
"An accident?" My incredulity is clear. "Why not just say that, then? Why the sinister message, the tacky card?"
Mark sits down with a long sigh that I think, I hope, is less about me and more about having spent the day in a stuffy classroom. "Perhaps someone's trying to point the finger. Negligence rather than a deliberate act. Who's responsible for maintaining the cliff edges?" I say nothing, and when he continues, his voice is softer. "You see what I mean, though. It's ambiguous."
"I suppose it is. Except Mum left her handbag and phone on the edge of the cliff, which would be a weird thing to happen accidentally as you fell."
"Unless she'd put them down first, so she didn't drop them. She was looking over the edge or trying to rescue a bird, and the edge crumbled, and..."
I sit down heavily next to Mark. "Do you really think it was an accident?" He twists around so we're facing each other. When he speaks, it's gentle, and he keeps his eyes trained on mine. No, sweetheart. I think your mum was desperately unhappy after your dad died. I think she was more unwell than anyone could have known, and... He pauses, making sure I'm listening. I think she took her own life. Nothing he's saying is new to me, yet my heart drops back into my stomach, and I realize how much I wanted his alternative narrative to be true. How ready I am to grab onto a lifeline that hasn't even been thrown. All I'm saying is that everything's open to interpretation, including this card. He puts my phone face down on the coffee table. The photo's obscured. Whoever sent it wants to mess with your head. They're sick. They want a reaction. Don't give it to them. The man at the police station put it in an evidence bag. He said they'd check for fingerprints. They're taking it seriously, I want to add. Did you see a detective? No, just the man who works on the front desk. He was a detective for most of his service, and when he retired, he came back as a civilian. That's dedication. It is, isn't it? Imagine loving your job so much you don't want to leave it, even after you've retired. Or you're so institutionalized you can't imagine doing anything else. Mark yawns, his hand too late to catch it. From the front, his teeth are a perfect pearly white, but from this angle, I can see the amalgam fillings in his upper molars. Oh, I hadn't looked at it that way. I think of Murray Mackenzie, with his careful concern and insightful comments, and whatever the reason, I'm glad he's still working for the police. Anyway, he was lovely. Good. In the meantime, the best thing you can do is put it out of your mind. He scoots to the corner of the sofa, his legs stretched out, and raises one arm in invitation. I slide into our well-worn position, snuggled under his left arm with his chin resting lightly on the top of my head. He smells of cold air, and something I can't quite pinpoint. Have you been smoking? I'm curious, that's all, but even I can hear the judgment that lies beneath the surface of my words. A couple of drags, after we finished. Sorry. Do I stink? No, I just didn't know you smoked. Imagine not knowing your partner smokes. But I've never seen him with a cigarette. Never even heard him mention it. I quit years ago. Hypnotherapy. It's what made me go into counseling, actually. Have I not told you this story? Anyway, every few months I light one, have a few drags, then stub it out. It reminds me I'm the one in control. He grins. There's logic to it, I promise. And don't worry, I would never do it around Ella. I settle back into him. I tell myself it's exciting that we're still discovering things about each other. What we have in common, what sets us apart. But right now, mystery isn't what I need in my life. I wish Mark and I knew each other inside out, that we'd been childhood sweethearts. I wish he'd known me before Mum and Dad died. I was a different person then. Curious. Amused. Amusing. Mark doesn't know that Anna. He knows bereaved Anna. Pregnant Anna. Anna the mother. Sometimes, when Laura or Billy is around, I'll lose myself in a time before Mum and Dad died, and I'll feel like the old me again. It doesn't happen often enough. I change the subject. How was your course? Lots of role play. I hear him grimace. He hates that sort of thing. You're later than I thought you'd be. I dropped by the flat. I don't like leaving it empty. When Mark and I met, he was living in Putney. He saw clients in a room of his seventh floor apartment and spent one day each week at a practice in Brighton. The same practice that distributed flyers around Eastbourne at the very moment I most needed it. I told Laura about the pregnancy test before I broke the news to Mark. What am I going to do? Have a baby, I guess, Laura grinned. Isn't that how it usually works? We were sitting in a cafe in Brighton, opposite the nail bar where Laura used to work. She'd found a new job taking customer calls for an online shopping company, but I saw her looking at the girls laughing in the nail bar, and wondered if she was missing the banter.
I can't have a baby.
It didn't feel real. I didn't feel pregnant. If it wasn't for the half-dozen tests I'd done, and the absence of a period, I'd have sworn it was all a bad dream. There are other options. Laura spoke softly, even though there was no one else within earshot. I shook my head. Two lives lost were already too many.
Well then.
She held up her coffee mug in a mock toast.
Congratulations, mummy.
I told Mark over dinner that night. I waited till the tables around us were full, protected by the company of strangers. I'm sorry, I said, when I'd dropped my bombshell. There was a flicker of confusion on his face.
Sorry? This is amazing, I mean, isn't it?
He scrutinized me.
You don't think so?
He tried to be serious, but a slow grin was spreading across his face, and he looked around the restaurant as though expecting a round of applause from our oblivious dining companions.
I wasn't sure.
But I put my hand on my still flat stomach and thought that after the awfulness of the previous year, here was something good. Something miraculous.
Okay, so it's maybe a little faster than we might have wanted.
Just a bit. I could count the weeks we had been together on my fingers. But it is what we wanted. He looked for agreement, and I nodded vehemently. It was. We'd even talked about it, surprising ourselves with our candor. Mark was 39 when we met, bruised from a long-term relationship he'd thought was permanent, and resigned to the possibility that he might never have the family he wanted. I was only 25, but painfully aware of how short life was. My parents' deaths had brought us together. This baby would provide the glue to keep us there. Gradually, Mark wound down his London-based business and scaled up his Brighton one, moving in with me and renting out the Putney flat. It seemed the perfect solution. The rent covered his mortgage, plus a little extra, and the tenants seemed happy to fix anything that went wrong. Or so we'd thought, until a call from Environmental Health informed us the upstairs neighbour had complained about a smell. By the time we got there, the tenants had left with their deposit and a month's rent owing, leaving the place trashed too badly to rent out straight away. Mark was gradually putting things back together.
How's it looking?
Grim. I've lined up someone to decorate, but they're on another job till mid-January, so it'll be February before there's a chance of a deposit from new tenants.
It doesn't matter.
It does.
We fall silent, neither looking for an argument. We don't need the rental income. Not now. We're not short of a bob or two, as Grandad Johnson would have said. I'd hand back every penny if it meant one more day with my parents. But the bottom line is, their deaths left me solvent. Thanks to Grandad Johnson, the house has never been mortgaged, and a combination of Dad's savings and my parents' life assurance policies means that sitting in my bank account right now is a fraction over £1 million.
I'll sell the flat.
Why? This is bad luck, that's all. Switch agencies. Find one that checks out references better.
Maybe we should sell both places.
For a second, I don't register what he's suggesting. Sell Oak View.
It's a big house, and the garden's a lot to maintain when neither of us knows what we're doing.
We'll get a gardener. The sycamore went on the market for £850, and it's only 4 bedrooms.
He's serious.
I don't want to move, Mark. We could buy somewhere together. Something that belongs to us both.
Oak View does belong to us both.
Mark doesn't answer, but I know he doesn't agree. He moved in properly at the end of June, when I was 4 months pregnant and Mark hadn't spent a night at his flat in weeks.
Make yourself at home, I said cheerily,
but the very fact that I'd said it reinforced my ownership. It was days before he stopped asking if he could make a cup of tea, weeks before he stopped sitting bolt upright on the sofa like a visitor. I wish he loved the house the way I do. With the exception of my 3 years at uni, I have only ever lived here. All of my life is within these four walls.
Just think about it,
I know he thinks there are too many ghosts here, that sleeping in my parents' old bedroom is hard for me. Perhaps it's hard for him too. Maybe. But I mean no. I don't want to move. Oakview is all I have left of my parents.
Ella wakes at 6 on the dot. 6 a.m. used to be early, but when you've been through weeks of night wakings and resigned yourself to starting your day at 5, 6 a.m. feels like a lie-in. Mark makes tea, and I bring Ella into bed with us, and we have an hour as a family before Mark has his shower, and Ella and I go down for breakfast. Half an hour later, Mark's still in the bathroom. I hear the clanging of the pipes and the rhythmic knocking that provide the musical accompaniment to our ensuite shower. Ella is dressed, but I'm still in my pajamas, dancing around the kitchen to make her laugh. The crunch of gravel outside makes me think of yesterday evening. As the morning light creeps into the kitchen, I'm embarrassed by the way I worked myself into a state. I'm relieved Robert's phone was switched off, making Mark the only witness to my paranoia. Next time I'm alone at night, I'll play loud music, turn on lights, walk through the house slamming doors. I won't cower in one room, creating a drama that doesn't need to exist. I hear the metallic snap of the letterbox, the soft thud of letters dropping onto the mat beneath, and then the lightest of finger taps that tells me the postman has left something in the porch. When Ella was 5 weeks old and full of colic, the postman delivered a textbook Mark had ordered. It had taken me a full hour to settle her, and she had finally dropped off to sleep when the postman banged the door knocker with such force the light fittings rattled. I wrenched open the door in a sleep-deprived postnatal rage, giving the poor man both barrels and then some. Afterwards, when my fury had burned itself out and my cries no longer rivaled Ella's, the postman suggested he might simply leave further packages outside the door, with no danger of disturbing us. It appeared I was not the only house on his round at which this was the preferred modus operandi. I wait until his footsteps leave our drive, not wanting to greet him in my pajamas, and still mortified by my tears that day. Then I pad into the hall and collect the post. Circulars, more bills, an official-looking letter in a buff envelope for Mark. I take the key from its hook beneath the windowsill and unlock the front door. It sticks a little, and I pull hard to open it. But it isn't the force of opening the door that makes me take a step back, or the icy cold sucked instantly into the warm hall. It isn't the parcel that rests on the pile of logs to one side of the porch. It's the blood, smeared across the threshold, and the pile of entrails on the top step. Chapter 13. They say money is the root of all evil, the cause of all crime. There are others like me, other people wandering around in this half-existence, and they're all here because of money. They didn't have any. They had too much. They wanted someone else's. Someone wanted theirs. And the result? A life taken. But it won't end there. Chapter 14. Anna. The rabbit is on the top step, its stomach cut neatly open in one continuous, careful slice. A gelatinous mass of flesh and guts oozes from within. Glassy eyeballs stare out at the street, above a gaping mouth exposing sharp white teeth. I open my mouth to scream, but there's no air in my lungs, and I take a step back instead, clutching at the coat stand to the side of the front door. I feel the prickle of my milk letting down, the need to feed my baby an instinctive reaction to danger. I find air.
Mark!
The word explodes from me bullet fast.
Mark! Mark!
I keep shouting, unable to tear my eyes away from the bloody mess on our threshold. A morning frost has coated the rabbit and its blood in glistening silver, and the effect serves only to make the spectacle more macabre, like a gothic Christmas decoration.
Mark!
He comes downstairs at something between a walk and a run, stubbing his toe on the bottom step and swearing loudly.
What the... Jesus!
He's wearing nothing but a towel, and he shivers involuntarily as he stands in the open doorway, staring at the step. Droplets of water cling to the sparse hair on his chest.
Who would have done such a horrible thing?
I'm crying now, in that post-shock relief that comes with realizing you're safe. Mark looks at me, confused. Who? Don't you mean what? A fox, presumably. Good job it's so cold, or it'd be stinking. You think an animal did this? A whole park across the road, and it chooses our doorstep. I'll get some clothes on, then I'll get rid of it. Something doesn't make sense. I try to work out what, but it slips away from me. Why didn't the fox eat it? Look at all that meat and... I swallow the nausea that threatens my gullet.
The guts. Why kill it and then not eat it?
That's what they do, isn't it? Urban foxes feed from the bins. They kill for fun. If they get into a hen coop, they'll slaughter the whole flock, but they won't eat a damned one. I know he's right. Years ago, my father decided to keep geese penned in a run at the bottom of the garden. I can't have been older than 5 or 6, but I remember pulling on my wellies and running to collect the eggs and throw grain onto the muddy grass. Despite the geese's Christmas fate, my mother named them all, calling them individually as she rounded them up at nightfall. Her favorite, and by default, therefore, mine, was a sprightly bird with grey-tipped feathers she called Piper. While the others would hiss and flap their wings if you got too close, Piper would let my mother feed her by hand. Her docility was her undoing. The fox, so bold he didn't wait for darkness, was deterred by the bad-tempered siblings, but clamped his jaws around poor Piper's neck, leaving her decapitated body for my mother and me to find that evening. Filthy animals, Mark says. You can see where the fox hunt brigade's coming from, can't you? I can't. I've never seen a fox in the countryside, but I've seen plenty in town, trotting down the center of the street, as bold as you like. They're so beautiful I can't imagine terrorizing them in punishment for their own instincts as hunters. As I stare at the mutilated rabbit, I pinpoint what's been troubling me. I speak slowly, the thoughts solidifying along with the words. There's too much blood. There's a pool of it beneath the lifeless rabbit, and more on the 3 steps down to the drive. Gentle amusement shows on Mark's face as he takes in my announcement. I remember dissecting frogs in 4th form biology, but we never did a rabbit. How much blood should there be? The sarcasm irritates me. Why isn't he seeing what I'm seeing? I try to stay calm. Let's suppose a fox did it, and let's suppose there's enough blood in a tiny wild rabbit to produce this mess in front of us. Did it wipe its paws on the other steps? Mark laughs, but I'm not joking. Did it use its tail to paint smears of blood? Because that's what it looks like. Like someone has taken a paintbrush, dipped it into the rabbit, and covered our steps with irregular daubs of blood. It looks, I realize with sudden clarity, like a crime scene. Mark becomes serious. He puts a strong arm around me and uses his free hand to close the door. Then he turns me to face him. Tell me. Tell me who did this.
I don't know who did it, but they did it because I went to the police. They did it because they know something about Mum's death, and they want to stop me finding out about it.
Voicing my theory does nothing to make it sound less fantastical. Mark is impassive, although I detect a hint of concern. Sweetheart, this doesn't make sense.
You think this is normal? An anonymous card yesterday, and now this.
Okay, let's think this through. Suppose the card wasn't someone being spiteful.
It wasn't.
What did they want to achieve by questioning your mother's death? He doesn't wait for me to answer. And what did they want to achieve by scaring you with dead animals on the doorstep? I can see his point. It feels disjointed. Why push me towards the police, then warn me off? He takes my silence as defeat. It was a fox, sweetheart. Mark moves forward and kisses my forehead.
I promise.
Why don't I take Ella while you have a nice bath? I haven't got a client till 11 today.
I let Mark lead me upstairs and run me a bath, putting in some of the ludicrously expensive bath salts he bought me when Ella was born, which I've never had time to use. I soak beneath the bubbles, thinking about foxes, rabbits, blood, wondering if I'm paranoid. I picture the anonymous card, imagine the sender's hands sliding it into the envelope, putting it in the postbox. Did that same person cut open a rabbit with surgical precision, smear blood across the steps of my house? My pulse won't slow down. It beats a staccato rhythm in my temple, and I sink lower in the bath, letting the hum of the water fill my ears instead. Someone wants to frighten me. I wonder if the two acts are really that disjointed after all. I saw the anonymous card as a call to action, a direction to look into my mother's death. But what if it wasn't an instruction, but a warning? Think again. A warning that Mum's death wasn't as it seemed, that someone out there meant my family harm, still does. I close my eyes and see blood. So much blood. Already my memory is playing tricks on me. How big was the rabbit? Was there really that much blood? Photographs. The thought occurs suddenly, and I sit up, sloshing water over the side of the bath. I'll take pictures, and then I can take them to Murray Mackenzie at the police station and see if he thinks it could have been a fox. A tiny voice asks if I'm doing this to convince Mark or to convince the police. I bat it away, pull the plug, and hop out, drying myself with such haste my clothes stick to my damp skin. I find my phone and rush downstairs. But Mark has already cleared away the dead rabbit and washed the steps with bleach. When I open the front door, there's nothing there at all. It's as if it never happened. Chapter 15 Murray. Winter sun filtered through the bedroom curtains as Murray got dressed. He tucked the duvet underneath the pillows and smoothed out the wrinkles before arranging the cushions the way Sarah liked. Opening the curtains, he noted the thick grey clouds rolling in from the north and put a V-necked sweater over his shirt. Later, once the dishwasher was on and he'd pushed the Hoover around and the first load of laundry was hanging on the line, Murray sat at the kitchen table with a cup of tea and a chocolate biscuit. It was 9:30. The hours stretched out in front of him. He remembered a time when a morning off was full of promise, full of expectation. He drummed his fingers on the table. He would go and see Sarah, spend the morning with her. Perhaps he could persuade her to go to the cafe, or to take a walk around the grounds, and go on to work from there. He was buzzed in by Joe Dawkins, Sarah's key worker, who had worked at Highfield for the last 10 years. "I'm sorry, love. She's having a bad day." A bad day meant Sarah didn't want to see him. Ordinarily, Murray would go straight home, accepting that everyone had times when they wanted to be alone. Today, he felt different. He missed Sarah. He wanted to talk about the Johnson job. "Would you try again? Tell her I won't stay long." "I'll see what I can do." Joe left him in reception, the hall of the original country house. It had been clumsily converted, long before listed buildings had become something to protect. Thick fire doors, all with keycode access, led off to wards and offices, and ugly woodchip paper covered both walls and ceiling. When Jo returned, it was clear from her face nothing had changed. Did she give any reason? BPD. That was the reason. Jo hesitated. Not really. She did, didn't she? Come on, Joe. You know I can take it. The nurse looked him square on, assessing him. Okay. She thinks you should be... She lifted her hands and made repeated quote marks in the air, disassociating herself from what was to follow. Fucking other people and not wasting your life loving a loony. Murray blushed. His wife ordering him to leave her,
and then attempting suicide at the prospect, had been a common theme throughout their marriage.